That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Well, that's what she said.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Hopefully you listened to last week's show. We had on Kevin Brilliant to talk about behavioral economics and how teams like the Bulls, where he works, use psychology-based research to help create customer experiences on game day, work best with their sponsors, and understand stuff like purchasing habits. And most of what we talked about involved the non-conscious, so the decisions that we make every day without even thinking about or understanding why. Could be subliminal marketing, could be the way your brain processes the order of the choices that you have, could be that you have positive or negative associations. It's all sort of the non-conscious things that we do every day, the decisions we make every day. Today's guest, Cy Wakeman, who I heard speak at the Global Sports Management Summit in Chicago a few weeks ago alongside Kevin, she talks more about conscious choices. So these are decisions that we make every day at work and at home and how they affect our happiness. Her speech at the event really resonated with me so much, in part because I thought a lot about the themes that I talk about on this pod a lot, like gratitude. There's actually a book called The Happiness Advantage, and its author said of his work on the brain and happiness, quote, "We can retrain the brain to scan for the good things in life, to help us see more possibility, to feel more energy, and to succeed at higher levels." So this is actually a scientific fact. According to researcher Walter Chen, quote, "Every time you reactivate a circuit, synaptic efficiency increases and connections become more durable and easier to reactivate. Whenever you do specific tasks over and over again, they take up less of your brain power over time." So that includes expressing gratitude and being happy, but also negative emotions and tendencies. So knowing what we know about how our brains work, you'd like to think people would understand the power of positive thinking and how dangerous it is to spend time complaining or thinking that the world's out to get you. Kevin Brilliant talked about how powerful regret is, how if we're in a line and the one next to us moves faster, we regret the choice we made. We feel it and remember it more strongly than when we choose the right line and we move faster. And this is especially true of people who always think the world is out to get them or who focus on things that go wrong in their lives more than right. In the case of Cy Wakeman's work, she says our interactions with coworkers and bosses and the people around us every day can be more productive and easier if we accept reality, or will be drama-filled and stressful if we let our egos take over. As she writes on her website about what she calls emotionally expensive employees, quote, "These were the folks who spent their time arguing with reality instead of confronting it directly. They contributed opinions instead of action. They judged others instead of offering help. They saw themselves as victims of cruel circumstances instead of understanding that circumstances are the reality in which they must succeed." So it's, if I had a bigger office, I would work better. If I had a more supportive husband, I would have more time to get things done. If I had a new computer, I would get the work done faster. If my boss wasn't such a micromanager, I would be focused instead of distracted. And that's not to say that some of these things aren't true, but how are you reacting to them? And are you making them a part of the solution, or are you simply complaining about them even though it doesn't fix them? Anyway, you'll understand better when she breaks it down for you. And after you listen to our conversation, hopefully you'll see whether the way you handle things at work and in life is positively or negatively affecting you. That conversation is coming up next.
That's what she said.
Stay tuned for more That's What She Said in just a minute. But now let me reach out to you and ask for your help. So whether this is your first time listening to my podcast or you've heard it 100 times. I want to know what you like about it. So please, if you're listening in Apple Podcasts, leave me a rating and a review under That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. If you like what you hear, make sure you're subscribed so that we're easy to find next time that you're looking for me. And if you subscribe in the ESPN app, we can send you an alert whenever we have a new episode, which is cool. So please rate, review, leave your thoughts, and you can always tweet me too at Sarah Spain.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Happy to be joined by Cy Wakeman, author, speaker, trainer. Her new book is No Ego, How Leaders Can Cut the Cost of Workplace Drama, End Entitlement, and Drive Big Results. Cy wants to revolutionize leadership and show people that happiness and success at work are not based on your reality, but how you react to that reality. In fact, all of her work falls under the banner of reality-based leadership. So thank you so much for joining me, Cy. Why reality? And when we hear that word, maybe we're not thinking of it in the way you intend us to. So why is everything reality-based?
You know, that's a great question. I stumbled upon reality-based leadership as a philosophy because oftentimes as a leader, my team was wishing for different circumstances. So when they would come to me, they would put all their energy into if only we had a different market or a different customer or different colleagues or if marketing was doing something different. And I would always come back and say, what's our reality right now today? And they would say, it is what it is. And I would say, let's focus on succeeding in this reality rather than the one we wish for. And so I became known as very reality-based, that we need to live skillfully in this reality and quit wishing for different circumstances. In the moment, they are what they are. When we succeed in those circumstances, then we can have impact in future circumstances. So it just was kind of organic.
Yeah, I remember when you spoke at the Global Sports Management Summit that one of the things that stuck with me was the idea that some people maybe are naturally more predisposed to make the excuses of, as you said, well, if I had a bigger team or if I liked my boss or whatever it is, I would be successful. But because I don't have those things, I'm going to be okay with either not being successful or not trying hard or just sort of getting by. And then there are other people who will understand that they might be better off with all those things, but are willing to still invest as much as possible in the current situation. And then hopefully eventually you'll get the bigger desk you wanted or the faster computer or whatever it is that you're blaming your lack of success on.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, when I see athletes interview after the game or I hear coaches or I hear CEOs talk, you can really tell the people that are reality based and they said, you know, we got outplayed on the field and we need to work on X, Y, and Z. Reality based thinking leads to accountability and what was my impact in this situation, where the others really, at least more victim thinking, they blame their circumstances for why they couldn't succeed. And our circumstances aren't the reasons we can't succeed. They're the reality in which we must succeed. So, you know, a true high-value player at work or in sports is the person that can succeed in any reality, not one that needs the deck stacked in their favor, because that's just not a high-value player.
And one of the things that you focus on, which I found so fascinating, was this idea of the ego. And I think when we all hear ego, we think just being boastful or being full of yourself. But you actually view it as sort of the lens through which we view what happens in the world and how it affects us. Can you explain that a little more? Because I've never thought about it that way in terms of particularly people at work and how that can affect whether the person you're working with is a positive or negative teammate.
Absolutely. Most people have not thought about how their ego comes out to play at work. And ego is different than confidence. Confidence is like, I have confidence in my ability, but ego has this self-interest to it, that they want to be right, or they want things their way, or there's a righteousness. So the ego is the part of our brain that operates as kind of a set of prescription glasses. The problem is it's the wrong prescription. So it's a filter, a lens through which we see the world, and it's a filter that distorts reality. It corrupts the data we get when we look at the world, and that corruption, it's like it distorts data in our favor. But in order to do that, I always say the ego needs to stay angry to stay alive. So it has to stay like mildly irritated. It's the source of judgment. And to be successful, I tell people, you know, stop judging, start helping. That means put your ego away, move beyond ego. When people are venting, they're in ego. When they're self-reflecting, they're in accountability. And a person can't do both at the same time. So the ego's that filter that we see the world through that says, I'm misunderstood, I'm undervalued, I should be listened to, I know best. It really is a way of leading where we really aren't seeing reality clearly, and we definitely aren't owning our part in reality, which then keeps us from impacting to the fullest extent that we could.
Yeah, and your example for that is a great one, and it speaks to a lot of the issues that you discuss, but to this one particularly. And it's the idea of a boss who calls and asks whether a certain project is done. And your response to that being ego-based or accountability-based will affect how you see that call.
Absolutely. So we have a premise in reality-based leadership that you're stressed in life. Anytime you're feeling, you know, that you're consuming more energy than you need to, like you're feeling winded, so to speak, your stress comes from your story, not your reality. So the stress comes from not from reality, but the story you make up from reality. So the example I use is if I'm reality-based, if I'm not in my ego, if I'm just an accountable person, I may get a phone call from my boss, and I answer the phone, and my boss says, hey, Si, how are you coming on project, you know, Smart Water? And if I'm reality-based, I have nothing, no defense, I'm just honest and true and looking to be a good sport, I say, you know, I'm behind on that project. I just tell the truth. And my boss might say, you know, gosh, I've noticed you're behind on a lot of things. And, you know, if I'm just staying out of defensiveness, I try that on for size. I go, you know, I've noticed that about myself, too. What can you do to help me understand better the priorities? And we're having just this no ego conversation, and we're focused on how I can operate more successfully in the world. It's all good stuff. There's no pain, no suffering at all until I create a story, and the story comes from my ego, because your ego just narrates the world. But most people don't understand that it's their ego narrating, that it's not reality. And so I tell people, stop believing everything you think, because most people would take a simple phone call where I talked about needing to get better at priorities and getting a plan to catch up into, my boss is a micromanager. He treats me like a child. He's calling me about these projects because he's looking for one to cancel. And I know why he's doing this. He's looking to fire me. And I have a kid in medical school, and now my son will have to drop out. And he was going to help kids in Uganda. Now children in Uganda are going to die. And now I have like all the children of Uganda, you know, as my responsibility. And so I dare not admit that I'm behind on a project. And it's how our ego really takes reality and distorts it such that you are super stressed out. But when people stop believing everything they think and they just question, is it true my boss is a micromanager? No, my boss just called to check on a project. I made that up. And the freedom comes when you just start seeing reality for what it is. There's just really no need for defense and hiding, and you're just in the present moment. You're in the zone, so to speak, and you're not consuming extra calories.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes that I often talk about is Tom Petty's, most things I worry about never happen anyway. But what if your boss is a micromanager? What if that's reality-based?
So that might be reality-based. Let's say, and what I would do is we say, stop judging, start helping. So instead of calling my boss like a micromanager, because that's a judgment, I would say, I've noticed that my boss checks in more often on my projects than my past bosses have. See, that edits the story down to just more reality. And labeling him or her a micromanager, you know, we need to take the judgment out of it. So if that is, though, my case, that I'm working with someone who checks in more than I prefer, instead of focusing on how they need to be different, if that's my reality, I focus on this amazing question for self-reflection that gets me out of ego. See, the ego lives in the front of your brain, and to bypass it, we want to self-reflect, and that gets you into the core thinking part of your brain. The question I would ask is, what could I do to help? And my answer would be, if I had a boss that checked in a lot, is I would go to my boss and ask them, I would say, what are two or three things I could do to increase your confidence in my work so that you could go with maybe a once a week check-in on the status of the things I'm working on?
Right.
And see, I've completely changed the conversation. So walking in saying, I feel micromanaged, bam, that hits the boss's ego. The boss starts defending. We're now talking about what, you know, is the right way for someone to manage right and wrong. It starts the insanity. But instead, if I went to my boss and said, I want you to have confidence in me, what could I do so that you felt more comfortable and could be comfortable with like a once a week status report? That puts it all on me, and I've taken the judgment out of it. And now anything I find out is value added. And then what my boss tells me, I need to watch and not argue with. Those are just my simple instructions.
Yeah.
He may say, or she may say, you know, I need you to send me at least an email daily of how we're coming on these three key points. Then my name is yes. I just go, absolutely, let's start there. And then hopefully we can, in a few months, move to the next level. But it starts with me. My innovation is my natural state when the drama's gone. So So it starts with me, stop judging, start helping, focusing on what I can do to help, and really moving away from any type of judgment on what my reality is. Reality is just neutral.
Yeah, it feels to me like so much of what you preach is basic communication, but it's also it's a desire to move away from talking about someone and instead talking to them, and that relates to your examples of people coming in to gossip about another employee or part of the company that had something that went wrong. And this is another great example of the way that you describe the initial reaction of one employee is pretty human. But when you revise it and say a better approach, it feels like, well, clearly that's better for everyone involved, even if it's not our natural instinct.
Absolutely. And you're right to say this is good communication, but it's authentic communication. You can't fake this stuff. It's got to come from a place where you have done your own work and you've gotten to a place of neutrality. And so I surprise people because most leaders believe people need time to vent. And what I would tell you is venting is the ego's way of avoiding self-reflection, and that venting begets more venting. And it may feel good in the beginning, but I mean, so does crack cocaine. It's just not like a lifestyle, right?
Yes. And wait, so let's get to your example of venting, because I think that I do have this feeling that, you know, sometimes people do just need to get something off their chest and then they're like, I feel better and it's over. But you give examples of ways to respond to someone walking into your office to gossip.
Exactly. So somebody may come in my office and they're really heated up. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Maybe one's really frustrated that somebody made a mistake and that fell on their desk and they're having to fix it. And one example I give is a nurse in a surgical area, and admissions had actually put a wrong procedure on a chart. She was with the patient, started prepping the patient mentally for the procedure and realized that it was the wrong procedure. So she came to me and she was furious, and she's like, people in admissions do this crap on purpose and they need to be fired. And if I did my job like they did their job, I wouldn't last long. And she's saying, you know, the patient's upset, this place is dangerous. And I'm sure your listeners are thinking, oh my gosh, that could have been disastrous. But what I'm thinking is our process that we have in place to catch an error is working. Right. And so when she wanted to tattle, she was venting, and an ego bypass tool gets you out of ego and into self-reflection. It's just asking a simple question. And so I said, whoa, take a breath. Your brain needs oxygen. And I said, I just have a question for you. If you were great right now, if you were being a great nurse and employee, what would great look like? And everybody knows what great looks like because it's the standard we judge everybody else on. And it really took her aback, and she's like, well, you know, I would be back in the room with the patient. I'd be letting them know that the system's working and apologize for this, you know, potential error, restore their confidence, bring in the rest of the team, you know, really be present for the person and regain, you know, the confidence they have in us. And so then as a leader, all I had to say is, well, go be great. And this interrupting people's thinking is tricky, because another example is somebody came by to complain about IT, and they're like, IT has really screwed up this conversion, and they really have put us way behind, and they can't manage the way of a paper bag. And most managers, when they hear the systems are down and IT is to blame, they jump up and they go to overmanage and go fix something. But instead, I say lead first, manage second, meaning help your person grow to be more skillful in this reality, and then you can figure out how to impact it. So when she came in and she was venting, the first place I do is try and neutralize the drama. And I said, oh, I love that you're in my office sharing your love and concern about our colleagues in IT. And it just stopped her in her tracks, because it's a great reminder they're our colleagues. Instead of venting, I'm just going to assume that you're sharing love and concern. And if you work for me, on the back of your badge, you actually have, how can I help? Because we have a non-negotiable called stop judging, start helping. So that question is really important. And so as she was complaining, I said, you know what, let's just stop for a minute. I'm just wondering, what did you do to help? And she was stumped by that. She's like, what do you mean, what did I do to help? And I said, no, really, what did you do to help, given our colleagues really struggled through this data conversion? And she said, well, I'm in here telling you. And I just shared with her really lovingly. This stuff isn't used to put people down. I said, you know, that's not that helpful. And do you have your badge with your question on the back? I said, hey, let's go find Karen, who you're most upset with. And we happened to work in the same building. I took Tammy to Karen's office, and I said, you know, Karen, I heard you had a tough conversion. And Tammy was just in my office showing love and concern, and she has a question for you. And I said, go ahead, Tammy. And Tammy's mind was blown. She asked Karen, she's like, what can I do to help? And Karen had some really great answers for her that became simple instructions that, you know, when we have business requirement meetings, letting your team think they aren't mandatory just isn't that helpful. Like, it really helped not put blame back and forth, but to help everybody dial in to what's my part in these results. And it isn't about just winning and losing and that it's one person or one player that won or lost that game. It's about all of us identifying what was my part in these results, because if I can identify and account for how I got there, the ability to account for, I have this incredible freedom called responsibility, the ability to respond differently. And it really shows me where I need to grow next so that I can not be frustrated, you know, by Groundhog Day and the same thing happened to me every day. I can really impact my reality, but not by wishing reality was different, by first going into a non-judgmental place and accounting for my part and then changing my part and showing up differently, and then I get a different reality. It's very counterintuitive to many people.
Well, yeah, because I think a lot of people consider, if it's not my fault that this happened, it's not my job to fix it. And the problem is that if you would rather be right about it not being your fault, or you'd rather not be involved at all in something that went wrong, you're not actually promoting any success for yourself or your company. You're just being right.
Exactly. In fact, one of the things in my first book, Reality Based Leadership, we have a whole section on another great question. Would you rather be right or happy? Would you rather be right or successful? Our ego loves to be right, but that's not how we succeed in business or in sports. You know, I could be right that somebody shouldn't have bounced past me the ball. That was a dumb move, right? But we didn't win.
Right.
Or I could just go, that was a bounce pass and I'm diving for it. And we're going to get that ball back in play. And we're, you know, off and running again. You know, the emotional energy that players or employees can expend talking about a bad bounce pass in a game is more energy than if they would just hustle after the ball and get it back in play.
Right. So do you, I mean, I certainly know people whose natural position is to complain, right? Not only is their ego telling them that everybody's out to get them, but also they think this isn't my job, so I shouldn't have to do it. Or, you know, I shouldn't be asked to do this. It's somebody else's job that I'm now doing. Whether or not they are aware that that's not the most successful way to react, that's just their natural predilection. Can people really change? Do you really feel like people whose natural way of viewing the world is that way are likely to change?
You know, that's such a great question, because I call it BMW driving or bitching, moaning, and whining. There are three groups. So there's high accountables, medium accountables, and low accountables. High accountables tend to, and they probably weren't just born that way, but through life experience, they have just experienced so many great results from stepping up into accountability, and they really work hard to keep themselves in a state of high accountability and not get righteous. And mid-accountables can really be activated by great leadership, great team members. So, yes, those folks can start to be more aware. And I find when people hear me talk, if they're in medium or high accountable status, that it resonates with them. They're like, oh, my gosh, I need to pay more attention, and I need to – when I start feeling myself get really negative and complaining, I just need to, you know, move back to kind of a better path. There is a group of low accountables that in order for them to change their story, like at work, they would have to change their whole life story. And so there is a group that I personally think everybody's capable of change. As an employer, I don't always want to invest in the long learning curve it may take.
Right.
From some of my low accountables, I would rather play favorites. And in fact, one of the things I say a lot or get accused of a lot is when people work for me, they say, "Sai, you play favorites." And I often reply, "Yes, I do. Do you want to be one?" And, you know, that is, it can be a big group. Everybody can be my favorite. And I don't play favorites based on, you know, immoral and hopefully always illegal reasons like, you know, your gender or the color of your skin or who you love or, you know, who you worship. I play favorites based on how accountable you are and how great you are at change and how quickly you can say yes and align with the organization. So I think that it's possible for everybody to have some sort of spiritual awakening and change. I just know as an employer, I don't always want to invest the money and time, because if I'm working harder at somebody else's success than they are, then game over.
Right.
I'm only going to work with the willing. And that's my secret to success, is that people know that buy-in is a verb. They move first, they buy in by choice, and then I'll work with the willing.
So I feel like athletes, we talk a lot at ESPNW about the high percentage of women in the C-suite who were athletes at one point in their life. And I think the high accountability thing resonates, especially for me, in terms of recognizing it amongst athletes, because there's a lot of adversity that needs to be met and then moved past.
Totally.
And you do it so often, you don't even think about it anymore. And when you get later in life and you're surrounded by people who are not in that position, you kind of understand that it's much more natural, I think, for athletes to fight past something that's in their way and not get, you know, bogged down by it, because they get used to winning and losing and continuing.
And self-reflecting. Athletes are great at self-reflecting.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's essentially usually a meritocracy. If you don't win, it's because you didn't do as well. And your ego is not,
exactly.
It's difficult for your ego to convince you of any other reason, right? You could say the ref made a bad call or your coach made a bad choice, your teammate messed up, but it is, for the most part, a meritocracy. Yeah, exactly. Scoreboard.
Yeah, and what I say to people, that's the ultimate, you know, myself as an athlete and my kids playing athletics, it's like, you know, well, the ref made multiple bad calls. And I'm like, so sounds like you need to learn to play the game so great that a couple bad calls won't even, you know, hurt you. But I think people that I meet, especially women that are willing and able to be in that C-suite, really have learned the rules of the game. And I'm not talking about the politics, but even, you know, quite recently I herniated a disc in my back and I did 12 sitties in 12 days flying. And of course, you know, didn't want to take major painkillers on stage. And, you know, a sports lesson came back to me. It's like my coach telling me, you know, play injured. Sometimes you play injured. And I thought, you know, every day I'm just getting up and playing injured, but it's got to be done, you know?
Yeah.
And, I really think so many of the lessons of reality-based leadership are what you see from our finest examples of athletes. You know, we have some examples not so fine, but it really comes out.
So one of the things you also talk about is that once you make a decision, suffering is optional. And if you have somebody, a coworker, a friend, someone in your life who is constantly complaining but doesn't make a change, how do you kindly explain to them that their suffering is optional? Their decision to remain at a job they hate or with a boyfriend they hate or repeating a pattern that doesn't serve them is a decision and not a reality in the same way that you discuss reality, which is stuff you can't change.
Totally. You know, a lot of people are looking for what I call the third option. So a couple of pieces of counsel I would have for that is when you're working with colleagues, like a lot of people will say, you know, I just don't agree with what's going on, you know, here at the company, or I don't agree with, you know, the defense the coach is calling, and it's like my response is I ask questions to get them thinking, because the power of a leader is more about what you get people thinking about than what you tell them. If you tell them, it'll engage their ego. So I would say, you know, what's your plan to get on board with this and get aligned with it, you know, to love the strategy? And they might say, I don't have any plans, so I'm not gonna. And then I would say, then, you know, what's your plan to leave? And they say, well, I'm not going, I'm gonna stay. And I'm like, awesome, I love that you're saying, like, what's your plan to, you know, be all in and get on board? They might reply, well, I'm not gonna. And I just really stand back. I'm like, oh my gosh, it seems like you think there's a third option. Like you can stay in hate or stay in sabotage. And there is no third option. You can stay in joy or leave in peace. But I think so many of us, you know, settle, and they really don't understand that suffering is optional. There's two ways to go through today, joy or misery. I choose joy, but it's the same day, same boss, same schedule, but I have that power. But, you know, a favorite of mine with colleagues who like to kind of be negative, and I do this with a family member every once in a while, because in families, you know, we call each other up. I've got a bunch of siblings, and we may call each other up to talk about a third sibling, you know. Oh, my gosh, I'll call him, your brother Sam, you know, is doing X. And my response to someone who wants to dish on drama is I always respond, first of all, something really positive, like, oh, my gosh, I love Sam. And then I say, what should we be doing to help? And so it was a very real example. I had a sibling call me once and said, oh, my gosh, your brother's buying a house he can't afford, and he'll be destitute in retirement. And my first response to the gossip is, oh, my gosh, my brother, I love that guy. He's buying a house he can't afford. What should we be doing to help? And then I started thinking out loud. I'm like, I have extra money. I'll send him some. Or, you know, if he has retirement and he can't afford it, I have a big house and my kids will be gone, he could come live with me. And I just started problem solving. And my sister goes, well, I'm not doing any of that, and I'm not getting involved in that hot mess. And I just changed the subject. I'm like, okay, well, what are we doing for the 4th of July?
Right.
Because I almost, like, make it impossible for people to complain, because if there's a situation that's not ideal, I jump in with, oh, my gosh, I'm so glad you brought that up. What should we be doing to help? And I start brainstorming. But they either jump in to help or they back out. It kills drama immediately.
Yeah, and I think part of that is a decision of, you can give somebody all the advice you want. You can believe that they're making bad choices. Once you've given them the opportunity to change their choice by your opinion or your advice and they don't want to, then the only way, I guess, to keep moving on is to accept that you can't change someone else and either get them out of your life, because it happens too often and it's a real stress on you, or find a different way to approach it, right? Because you're... It's the same thing. The suffering is optional. If you continue to think about and process and vent and gossip about someone that is doing things that you don't agree with, you are choosing to make their bad choices yours as well by upsetting
you.
Totally. That's easier said than done. So much of this is easier said than done.
Yeah. If you're talking more about somebody than you are to them, that's a sign. But it's so true. It's like, I call it the examination of whose crime is bigger. So let's say that somebody said or did something to me that took 5 minutes of my day. Like, maybe they came to me for advice and then didn't use it. And so I gave them 5 minutes of advice and they didn't use it. That's 5 minutes. And then I'm the one who gives them the next 2 hours talking to another friend about how crazy they are that they didn't change their lives. And I'm like, whose crime is bigger? They maybe took 5 minutes from me, or I gave it if I want to be accountable. But I'm the one choosing to give another 2 or 3 hours focused on their life. And somebody once said to me, there's 3 lanes in life. There's my business. That's lane one. There's other people's business. That's lane two. And then there's, like, reality or God's business, or, you know, that's like lane three. And if you want to have stress, get out of your lane. And I'm like, that's so true. And it's, you know, a little bit about mind your own business. But if I leave my lane, it's not to tell people what to do or to judge them. It's to ask them how I can help. Otherwise, man, back to my lane. Because when I'm out of my lane, nobody's running my stuff. So I'm under accountable for my work and over accountable for somebody else's work every time I judge.
And you said, I think I heard you say that in relation to coworkers too, that if you're frustrated because you have a coworker who kisses butt and you don't want them to succeed because that's unfair, or if you're frustrated about one who doesn't do X or Y, that you are inviting yourself into them causing you stress by involving yourself in it. Like, if you have a coworker that bothers you because they come and talk to you every day when you need to work, and you tell them over and over not to, that's a different story. If there's someone that bothers you from afar and you simmer about it, you're only causing yourself the pain, not them.
Exactly. So, you know, their presence is gone. You're the one that's holding on to that. It's very true. And, you know, a lot of the secret to happiness and peace is managing our own energy and being very clear about where I want to put my energy and what I want to feed in my life. And if I'm feeding my discontent or, you know, feeding my happiness You know, it really is about energy management. Leaders just manage the energy of people. Don't focus here, focus there. And so many people focus on why we can't, and a great leader just needs people to focus on what we want to create and how we could. You're just taking energy from one thing and putting it to another. And so a good thing for everybody to do is check during the day, where are you putting your energy and for what return on investment? And because a lot of times our own discontent is coming for how we're spending our energy, not external circumstances.
Yeah, and that brings me to another point of yours, which is about how you deal with being busy or overworked. And we're all going to have those days or those times. But if the anticipation of that busyness makes it even worse, then we're doing ourselves no favors in terms of handling that stress.
Yeah, that really goes along with, you know, when we were little, I think we all like joined this religion of suffering. And, you know, and I said suffering is optional. You brought that up. Two ways to go through the day, joy or misery. But a lot of us are so good, like we even pre-suffer. Like I'll look ahead to my next 2 day schedule and it's not, you know, Friday yet, but I'm looking ahead on Monday and I'm already pre-suffering. Well, if I were efficient with my suffering, I would, you know, wait until Friday to suffer, but I'm like pre-suffering, or maybe it's 8 a.m. and I have a call with my boss at noon. It's like I start suffering 4 hours early. But a lot of us, we do crazy stuff, like we do group suffering. Like if you walk by Sarah, you walk by my cube and you have a smile on your face and I'm suffering, it's so tempting to go, well, Sarah, if you're happy, you must not have read this email yet, and call you over and make sure you join me in my group suffering. It's, you know, we're silly people that way. We resist happiness a lot.
Yeah. And why do you think people are likely to do that? Why? I still get the point of venting, even though I know you don't think it's necessarily, very efficient or productive. I do think for whatever reason, sometimes people feel better when they can just talk something through and someone empathizes with them. And that's really all they need. They don't need a solution. They need someone to hear them. Why do you think that we will sometimes choose to pre-suffer or to add that? Is it because of like self-pity? Like we want someone to feel sorry for us that we're so busy?
Well, and I think it's also ego, right? Ego needs to be the worst one, the victim, the misunderstood one, the too busy one. A lot of the suffering is ego-induced. And, you know, even venting, there's a difference between sharing a feeling and venting. And when we vent, so I may say I'm frustrated with Sarah. She didn't give me the information I needed. That's it. That's my feeling. Venting is when I go on to create a story about things that probably never happened. Like she does this on purpose, and I know that, you know, she's trying to set me up, and I know this. And that's where I just really push people on. Venting feels good short term, but if you know anything about neuroscience and the pathways, thinking negatively forms a neural pathway. And the vicious cycle is once a neural pathway is formed, it gets hungry. It likes to be itched. And so you need to feed it some, you know, dopamine or serotonin or whatever chemical that neural pathway is feeding on. And to do that, then you have to vent some more. Like to scratch a negative pathway, you have to be negative again. And that's why I think just sharing a feeling is one thing. But venting really is your way of avoiding self-reflection. So I may say, you know, I may call you up as my girlfriend and say, Sarah, I just had the worst day. I had to present on stage in my pajamas and I hate Southwest Airlines and they are ridiculous. And I lost my luggage and, you know, it was horrible. And you can empathize with me by, you know, saying, I'm sorry, you could sympathize with me by saying, oh my gosh, that's horrible. Don't you hate travel? And we can have a good call together. But when I made that call, because I love Southwest Airlines, and I was telling my girlfriend all about this, her name is Kathy, and I'm like, oh my gosh, it was just horrible, and I was a victim, I was in front of 2,000 people, and the clothes I traveled in last night, which was my pajamas, and I had to buy a scarf from the hotel gift shop, and pretend it was an outfit, and she heard me, and she empathized. She said, Sai, I'm sorry to hear that. And then her empathy was a call to greatness. She said, but what really happened? And I said, what really happened is I chose to spend time with the kids. I got to the airport late. when they told me my bags are late checked, I ignored the feeling in the pit of my stomach, and I chose not to grab an outfit to put in my carry-on. And it seems like the accumulation of all my choices led me to presenting in my pajamas today. And so letting people vent reinforces the belief that they're at the mercy of their circumstances, and that's a miserable place to be. But helping people understand how their choices played into that, it's not blame. It just frees you up to have a different outcome, which is like the ultimate reward.
Right. And you know, I preach a lot about gratitude. I just am naturally prone to it. And I talk about how I think it makes my life significantly better at all times, that I have a natural predilection for it, and that people, I think, who can't be satisfied ever, who always are looking for the next thing or are not able to think about the things that make them happy and what they already have, that's really difficult. And you talk, and you said, you know, the way your brain works, they say you can force yourself to be more grateful by every morning waking up and sending an email to someone, and it gets your brain thinking in that direction instead of the opposite.
That's true. It's the reverse of what I just talked about.
Yeah.
It's rebuilding new neural pathways.
Yeah. But I wonder if something happens that isn't your fault, your choices didn't really lead to it. There's really then no benefit to complaining either, even if it wasn't your fault, because it doesn't
right.
fix the problem.
It's a good point, and I love the point about gratitude. And if you know, for me, I have this base belief that everything happens in my favor. The universe has my back.
Right.
You know, so even if something happens that wasn't my fault, and I don't want to spiritually bypass it by saying, gosh, you know, that death of this person didn't affect me. I don't want to minimize anyone's grief, but I can, for myself, I can look back on so many things in my life that I thought were really the most negative places. And now with some perspective, I could see that they were probably, you know, the coolest things that could happen in my favor. And a practice of gratitude and trying to really mine, you know, those places where, you know, things fell apart and maybe we didn't have a lot to do with it. Mine those for, you know, why did this happen for my higher good? And, you know, what are all the benefits of this happening? I think it's mentally flexible. And part of being a great athlete is being ambidextrous, but part of being a great employee and leader is being mentally flexible. Like, instead of just thinking about something negatively, I could see how that would, you know, could be for my benefit as well. And really stretching people's chops around, you know, what are three things that are great that could come of this, really gets them mentally flexible. You know, and I think a lot of times people, I say if you can't get out of something, get way into it, because a lot of times we're tired and fatigued and we think we need rest or a break. But I really believe a lot of times my antidote to fatigue is wholeheartedness. You know, because if you think about it, like I've had those times where I'm like dead tired and I think I'm not going to work out today. I don't have time to do this. I'm just so exhausted. And I just, all I can think about is how I'm going to park the car and get to my couch. And then I get distracted because I love to garden by some weeds up front of my house. And I start with just one weed. I needed it gone because my neighborhood's pretty competitive. And I start with that one weed, and 3 hours later, I have the whole garden weeded, my front gardens, and I'm still in my work clothes. And I have to ask myself, what happened to my fatigue?
Yeah.
It didn't go away from rest. It didn't go away from a break. But it definitely went away with wholeheartedness. Because, like, when I got gardening, I was in the zone, man. Time just flew. And so I think athletes understand that the antidote to fatigue is wholeheartedness. Like, if I can't get out of this, then how can I get weight into this? And those moments we all enjoy when we're, like, just in the zone, whether it's in sports or at work, are just worth every minute. It's what keeps me going back golfing. Is I play like 18 rounds, I get one good shot, I'm like, I'm back, you know?
Yeah, and I think also there's something to be said for, I think the worst days when I used to have a desk job would be when I wasn't busy. I much prefer having something to do. And you've talked about this before, that most people would actually rather be very effective and successful and be good at what they do and get things done than sit around and slack and kind of be on the clock but not actually doing anything. But how do you convince people who think, I don't like my job, I don't like my boss, I don't like what I do, that they would actually be happier if they jumped feet first in, even if it's something that they don't like, if they just decided to care?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if we can convince people, but I like to influence people like a lot with our training. That's why we work so hard on social media and to get out to podcasts and to spread the word, you know, for everybody, you know, that follows us at Cy Wakeman or, you know, subscribes to our YouTube channel. We like to get the word out that, you know, it's easier to be happy. The weird thing about it is we step down and then justify why we had to, but no one likes to go home at the end of the day and to not have had impact. Like, to say to your friends or family, like, how was your day? You know, it was awesome. I just slacked off all day. Like, our human nature is fed by having impact, by believing we can make a difference in the world or by seeing the fruits of our labor. So it's so ironic that our defense mechanisms have us step down when it's actually the very opposite of what we could do that would make us feel good. You know, it's just like so many times I go home and I think, oh, I'll skip my workout, when that's the very thing that would increase the energy I need. But I don't know if you can convince people. I know you can show them through your own lifestyle. And I know that you can use some of the techniques we call ego bypasses that just call people up to greatness. What would great look like? What do you know for sure? What's the next thing we could do that would add value? How could you help? And if they just answer one of those questions that kind of interrupts their thinking, it may reveal a new truth to them that, you know, gosh, I could step in and do X to help. And once they take that action, it becomes really fulfilling and naturally motivating because people like to feel better. And when they just do a few tiny things we suggest, they start to suspect that life doesn't have to be so hard, that suffering really could be optional.
Right. And if you help work with people to convince them that all of these choices are the right choices and this is the approach and get your ego out of it and aim for not to have the drama and all that stuff, and then they do their best on all of that and they're still miserable, at that point do you say, okay, maybe you do need to change your reality and not your approach to it?
You're exactly right. And for me, it's not about once you've learned what you can learn in the reality you're in, definitely make a choice. Like if you don't like the boss you're working for, make a choice to leave, but leave in peace, not in blame. Like,
right.
It's not about, like, one of my friends got a divorce and we're all waiting for the big scoop. Like they were like happily married and they just announced one day they're getting a divorce. So we get a bottle of wine and we're like, you know, gosh, tell us what happened. I'll never forget her answer. She goes, you know, there are things he did that I liked and things he did that I didn't like. And I decided that my preference was more towards something other. And so we split. And I thought, how clean is that?
It's like, right.
She didn't blame him for being a bad guy or like, you know, she's like, I liked some things he did. I didn't agree or like some things he did. And I just realized that my preference was not to be married any longer. And so, you know, he and I made the decision to split. And so if you're in a reality that you don't like, I'm not saying be a victim. I'm saying either stay in play or leave in peace, but don't ever make it about the other person. And I say don't leave until you've made peace and you're no longer blaming your boss, because what you avoid comes back. Like that lesson, like if you don't learn how to work with a boss who tends towards needing more detail than you like, if that is still an emotional charge for you, I guarantee you, here's how life works. You'll get another boss just like that until you can learn to live skillfully with that boss and lots of other bosses.
Yeah.
And so I encourage people all the time. It's like, don't stay and suffer, you know, stay in joy or leave in peace. And it's okay, but, you know, places like Gallup say, well, people quit their jobs because they're leaders. And I say people quit their jobs and then blame their leaders because, you know, are there less than perfect leaders out there? Absolutely. My happiness comes when I know I can move about the world freely. And I know I mentioned Southwest. I adore them. I fly them all the time. And I love their logo. It's like, you know, you're free to move about the world. the most freedom comes not when I can trust you, but when I can trust myself around you. And so I'm not so dependent on my circumstances. The freest thing is that I can, you know, work for many different types of bosses. I can, you know, join many different types of teams. Now, if something crosses the line into abuse, I'm out. But I'm out by choice.
Yeah.
But otherwise, my field that I get to play on is so much bigger than most people's fields because they have so many conditions that they can really only play in a narrow space where it's like, you know, let's name the rules right now. Just tell me the rules. I'll learn them and we'll figure out how to win regardless. And that just gives you so many more options. People feel tired and limited and all of that is because they're seeing the world in a tired and limited way. You know, when I teach college classes, one of the first things I do is I have the projector projecting on the screen, and there's a blemish that is, looks like it's on the screen. And I'll ask a couple of my students, I'll say, hey, and I do this while I'm just teaching. I go, hey, can you go up and see what's wrong? Why is there a blemish on the screen? And every one of those students walks up to the screen to try and wipe it off.
Mm-hmm.
When the issue is with the projector, I always put a piece of paper on the projector.
Hmm.
So the reality is they should go up to the projector and take that little piece of tiny little piece of paper off, but they always think it's a screen. So the analogy I use is people always think it's the reality, but it's the projector. It's my mind. It's my lens. And so if you're looking at reality and you don't like what it looks like or there's a blemish, don't go wipe it off the screen. It's on the projector.
Hmm. That's fascinating. I'm keeping you long. Do you have another couple minutes?
I do. I'm loving
okay.
it.
Okay. I want to ask, so Neil Gaiman, in one of his famous speeches at a graduation, talked about the three things that you need to be successful, particularly as a freelancer, which is the work has to be good, it has to be on time, and people have to like working with you. And if you lose one of those three, you might still be okay, but you can never lose more than one. You might be okay. If it's late, but people love working with you and it's great, they might still keep you around. You know, if it's on time and it's great work and they don't like working with you, they might suffer through it because the product is good. You have a different way of using arithmetic to decide the value of somebody who is not good to work with. And you think that most people do not properly do the math on someone who's a drain because of drama.
Absolutely. And I actually like Neil's idea, too. I think that's just another way of kind of looking at the same thing. That's not sustainable if you can't show up, deliver, do it on time in a way that is easy to work with.
Yeah.
But we have an emotional, what we call the employee value equation, to figure out your true value. It's not just your performance. And I cover this in my second book, Reality-Based Rules of the Workplace. But your value to an organization is how you perform. Do you deliver currently what the organization needs, not what you think is great, not what you like to do, but what the organization needs? And by the way, that changes, you know, monthly, quarterly, yearly. So it's performance. Are you performing? Then the second component that you add into this to get your value is, are you ready for what's next? Will you be performing far into the future? It's like your readiness, your potential. So not just that you're doing it today, but are you growing fast enough that you are, you know, going to keep up with the times and be relevant and able to perform in the new world 3 years from now? Now, your performance today and your readiness for what's next, those are positive qualities. And most of us stop the math. They're like, I'm a rock star and I'm on the cutting edge and people should love me and value me and pay me more. But when you think about value, value isn't just what you contribute, but it also is a ratio about what it costs us. So my shoes are awesome, but whether or not they have high value depends on the cost of that pair of shoes. So there's a third component we found called emotional expensiveness. We call it your drama quotient, your freakout factor. So your performance and your readiness, okay, that's part of the equation. But before you know your whole value, you've got to subtract out the total cost of you in addition to your salary and benefits. Like, what's your hassle factor? And we know that this is all about emotional expense. It's about low accountability, high ego, resistance to change, lack of buy-in, like the third option, staying and complaining instead of stay and enjoy or go in peace. And what we were shocked to find out is that that third component has a multiplier of 3, meaning that it subtracts at the rate of 3 times your contribution in performance and potential. And it's easier to see this visually, but let's say on a scale of 1 to 5, I perform at a 3. I'm an average performer. Scale of 1 to 5, I'm ready for what's next. I'm keeping up with the times. That's the 3. 3 plus 3 equals 6. Most people stop the math right there and feel really good about themselves. But on a scale of 1 to 5, the scale's inverted, with 1 being low maintenance and 5 being like unfit for human consumption.
Yeah.
Let's say I'm a 2. 6 minus 2 would be a 4. That'd still be a good number. But we found this crazy multiplier that would take that 2 of emotional expensiveness and make it a 6. My value number actually would be a 0. And a lot of people think, why would Sarah Spain have a 0 on her podcast? But that's actually our goal, is that's the no ego number. Because if I am a 0, I came, I gave great stuff, I got paid exactly what I asked for, and I go home every night with energy left over for friends and family. I end every day even, which is an awesome place to be. And I think a lot of people like to go home even. And it's a bit of a visual concept, but we really factor in your drama quotient, your emotional expense, and that outweighs your performance and your readiness 3 to 1. And so, you know, not to overuse sports analogies, but I mean, there's the 3-point shot and there's the,
right,
you know, 1-point
right,
free throw. And it's nicer to rack up 3-point shots on the board. And that's what you can do by being low drama in your workplace.
Well, and we talk about it in the sports world, the locker room cancer is what we call those people. And in some cases, they are bad enough to disrupt an entire team and they're better off without them. And in other cases, they have enough points on the other side that the drama doesn't take enough off to merit you know, getting rid of them, or at least not for a couple of years. By the end of it, maybe they decide it was too much. usually you discover later.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah. You need to cut your losses early or help them limit that drama, because I hear people all the time say, well, she's a great nurse. You know, she's horrible to her colleagues, but she's a great nurse. I'm like, well, how do you define great?
Yeah.
Or, you know, people are like, you know, they're an incredible athlete. You know, they're really negative and they're really toxic in the locker room, but they're incredible. I'm like, well, how do you define incredible? You know, we're doing bad math when you're leading yourself to believe that their, you know, amazing play on the court or the field or the diamond offsets the damage they do. You got to do better math and realize the damage that's being done by some of these people that are super high in their emotional expense.
Yeah. Well, to put a bow on it, this is a lot of great stuff. And people can find more on realitybasedleadership.com and check out, you have a couple different books and podcasts and a variety of ways, YouTube channel that people can find out. I think to me, the key in the end is like you said, it's accountability and awareness. So figuring out if you do all these things that are detrimental to you and people around you and you don't even know it because you're making excuses for why you have to act that way or why you're making that decision, instead of saying accountably, well, there are other things I could do and they probably would be better choices.
Absolutely. And in all 3 of my books, the No Ego is out for pre-order right now. They aren't about or written for people that are like completely broken. They're for the average person who wants to really up their play at work and up their happiness level. And it gives you techniques not only to keep yourself in a place of accountability, because your happiness is correlated to your level of accountability, but also how to lead and work with colleagues to stay out of the drama. So there's just tons of tools and techniques. And you can follow us on social media at Cy Wakeman, Instagram, YouTube, all the traditional places.
Yeah, such good stuff. I loved listening to you speak, and I'm just fascinated by how few people want to think harder about how the way they view the world affects their happiness. How many people will just kind of wade through and never take accountability for the mental choices that they make. Before I
and
let you go,
once you can do that, happiness is yours.
Right. Before I let you go, you have to do one last thing.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
Painting. like artistic, beautiful painting.
Oh, all right. Number two, Desert Island album. You can only have one.
Oh, Fleetwood Mac.
Ooh, good, good. I want to see Stevie Nicks in a couple of weeks. I'm excited. She's the best. Three, if you could switch lives with someone for a day, who would it be?
Lives with someone for a day? Let's see. Oh, I just have a crush on him. I would like to switch with Michelle Obama.
Oh, okay. Because you get to be her and you get to be with him?
Yeah, yeah.
There you go. What's the most scared you've ever been?
The most scared I've ever been, actually, this is, hopefully won't traumatize your audience. The most scared I've ever been, when I was younger, I aspirated, I choked on a sunflower seed, and they did a tracheotomy with my mom holding me down without anesthesia.
Oh, God. That sounds awful. Why, because they just didn't have time?
I couldn't breathe. It was freaky. Yeah. What?
They didn't have time to give you anesthesia?
Yeah.
That was when I just had to go in.
Oof. I was on the edge.
All right, five. What habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Oh, my best habit or quality is the word yes comes out of my mouth pretty quickly. Like, I just say yes. I say my name is yes. So you say, you want to do a podcast? I'm like, heck yeah. And I think I say, you know, sure, let's go for it. And not overthinking it and not saying no, unless it's illegal or immoral or something, I think has really led me to some incredible people and places.
Yeah. What's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
Oh, the thing I would like to most improve is I would like to be more disciplined in my meditation and my yoga practice. I would like to show up more often for both of those.
Nice. And finally, what three words would you most hope that people would use to describe you?
Three words to describe me. Big love. That's two, but that only counts as one. Like, big love. Like, they really feel loved around me. Generous. And, oh, gosh. Third one. That's another cheater. Great mom. I've got eight great sons. So,
oh, my goodness.
Two for one.
Eight sons. Is this a Brady Bunch
eight
situation,
sons.
Or did you pop them all
it
out?
It is. Four of my husbands and four of mine.
Okay, four is bad enough, but...
Exactly. We've got lots... The smell of Axe in our home
takes
your breath away.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for your time. I love talking to you. I really appreciate it.
Sarah, thank you.
Oh, and another thing.
Today's That's What She Read is a little bit of home cooking. It's a story about Diana Taurasi that Michelle Vopel wrote for ESPNW entitled Being the Best Teammate Possible is More Important to Diana Taurasi Than WNBA Scoring Mark. In case you missed it, Diana broke the WNBA's all-time regular season scoring record, moving past Tina Thompson. She had 19 points on Sunday in the Mercury's win over the Sparks, and now she has 7,494 points in her 377 regular season WNBA games, best of all time. And it was pretty cool to see the people who reached out, Kobe, LeBron, Mia Hamm, Carly Floyd, Kevin Durant, Larry Fitzgerald, a bunch of teams to congratulate Diana. So cool story from Michelle Vopel on that accomplishment, and you can find it on ESPNW.com. Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.